Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amber Nickel, the host of the channel, and today we are going to be speaking with Jacqueline Granick about her publication, International Jewish Humanitarianism in the Age of the Great War, which came out last year with Cambridge University Press. The book also recently won the National Jewish Book Award for writing based on archival material. So congratulations on that, Jacqueline. Jacqueline is a senior lecturer, which is similar to an associate professor, in modern Jewish history at Cardiff University in the United Kingdom. She completed her PhD at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies and was a postdoctoral researcher at Oxford, supported by several research grants, including a Fulbright. Jacqueline, welcome to the channel. I'm really excited to discuss this text with you today.
Thank you.
I want to start out with kind of the question I always start out with, and that's what motivated you to research and write International Jewish Humanitarianism in the Age of the Great War?
That is a question that has evolved, an answer to that question has evolved over time. But when I first started out, I would say I went to Geneva, Switzerland, where I did my PhD, in order to study international social movements and human rights. And as I was in a history department, I started to try to think about the way in which human rights and humanitarianism and international social movements had histories. And because I had already studied Yiddish as an undergraduate, mainly out of interest, I realized that I would be able to access the Jewish past in this way. So I started trying to come up with various ways of thinking about combining international history and modern Jewish history. And I landed on this era because I think that the Great War was an enormous event in modern history, which we tend to not think that much about today, probably just because World War II was even bigger and more recent. And I realized that there was a whole Jewish story in here that was very little told, also probably because of the Holocaust.
I think that's one of the great things about your book, actually, is that you talk about the ways in which World War II overshadows World War I in many ways, thinking about this. So can you please talk a little bit about the circumstances surrounding World War I, which you show to be a major inflection point in Jewish history?
Yes. So I call it the Great War because at the time, it was the Great War rather than the first of two major world wars within the space of a generation. When we look at a map of Europe, that map looks more or less like the peace map drawn up in 1919. World War One was when the major empires started to fall apart, and the map was redrawn in a very persisting way. And that World War One has this immense long-standing effect of geopolitical organization, which affects everyone in those regions' lives, that we tend not to really think about. When it comes to Jewish history, Jews were basically living right along the Eastern Front of this war. So if our standard narrative sitting in the West, even as Jews, tends to be mostly around national patriotic myths and Jews serving in the army, actually, there's this whole story of the Eastern Front, where from the Baltics through East Central Europe, down into the Balkans and into the what was the Ottoman Empire, Jews are in the crossfire. And like other civilians, they are subjected to battling armies, paramilitary groups, hunger, disease. But there's also explicitly Jewish, anti-Jewish violence that takes place within this. Most people know about the pogroms of 1918 to 21 that happened in Ukraine, but there were other major instances of anti-Jewish violence happening earlier in the war, not just in Ukraine. And I would also argue that those pogroms were part of what I call the age of the Great War, rather than thinking of the Great War narrowly as starting in 1914 and ending in 1918. There is a scholarship coming out about how the Great War really can be understood as persisting several years past 1918. And then at the end of the war, there's all of these sweeping political opportunities that come to light that might help Jews, such as the Balfour Declaration and the possibilities of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, and the minorities treaties, which make it seem like maybe there would be some hope of having an autonomous Jewish cultural life in the new states of East Central Europe. But alongside those, I would argue another major thing that happens in the Jewish world in World War One is the rise of American Jewish leadership through its major humanitarian project. And let me also add, because I forgot to list it earlier, the Russian Revolution also provided some major political answer to the struggles of Jews in modern Europe by emancipating them and showing the possibility of a life as Soviet, full Soviet citizens. So this moment, this long moment, was really probably the most important time in modern Jewish history, second only to the Holocaust.
So I think that leads us to maybe one of the largest questions surrounding your book, maybe the question that your book seeks to answer. And that is, how is it that we should, as scholars and as thinkers, situate and understand the importance of international humanitarianism in Jewish history?
I think that what my book really tries to argue is that while Jewish humanitarianism, which really came of age and was invented in some sense in this moment, was much like other forms of humanitarianism, which I'll maybe get to talk about later. In Jewish history, it was not merely a short-term reaction in which monies went from strangers to and donors to other strange recipients. Jewish humanitarianism was characterized through and through by the diaspora nature of Jewish life, which meant that donors and the organization and the recipients all felt themselves to be somehow connected, and it was a project of Jewish solidarity. And eventually, as the years wore on and Jews were still struggling to find their footing in post-First World War society, Jewish humanitarianism started to take on some of the roles that we might now associate with that of the social welfare state, or might alternatively associate with international development projects. It was Jewish humanitarianism that was sort of this glue holding the Jewish world together, raising money from Jews in the West who were more secure and sometimes more financially comfortable to keep Jewish life and culture going in its precarious state wherever it existed. And doing so much more than providing emergency food and medical relief, but restoring and also creating a new Jewish culture and political and social projects in this period.
So I want to now kind of start working through some of the meat of your book. And we'll kind of do it chronologically for the readers that are listening and thinking about picking up the text. So you start off with, I think, a really interesting analysis of the ways in which American Jews worked alongside and in response to other American humanitarian efforts that were occurring during and after World War I. Can you tell us a little bit about how Jews interacted with other American efforts and why they functioned in this manner?
Yeah. So my book really shows that the rise of American Jewish humanitarianism was really connected to the place of America in this global war. And for the first 3 years until 1917 of the First World War, America was the largest neutral power. And, you know, much like people are feeling today in the context of the war in Ukraine, Americans were very aware of the war in Europe, and they wanted to do something. And neutrality afforded them the opportunity to undertake humanitarianism. And it was really the first time that the technology was in place, that America had the standing that it did to kind of offer this huge humanitarian undertaking to war-torn Europe. So American humanitarianism as a whole kind of came into being, especially in its international form, in response to the First World War and in the condition of America being a neutral power. And that created a range of responses and organizations, which included the American Red Cross, which had previously existed but had rarely undertaken international work, and that also included this new organization run by future President Herbert Hoover called the American Relief Administration, And then a number of ephemeral and small organizations taken up, created by universities or by towns or by women's groups or other charitable societies. And then there were a few organizations that were organizations of the diaspora in the U.S., Polish diaspora, Near Eastern diaspora, and the Jewish diaspora. So the American Jews created the Joint Distribution Committee in response, direct response to the war, in the same way that all of their American peers were also creating humanitarian organizations in direct response to the war. And the Joint Distribution Committee, from its beginning, really needed to rely on American state power to do any of the work it wished to do, because the wartime landscape made it really difficult to function otherwise. Plenty of American Jews, often recent immigrants, would try to just do things on their own, like send money overseas. But between censors and failures of the international banking system and recipients being themselves refugees, it was impossible to actually reach the intended destination. So the Joint Distribution Committee was able to work with these other American humanitarian organizations to collectively move cash overseas and have them be negotiated through America's neutral power status. And during, before 1918, that really mostly looked like cash transfers, but also American Jews were able to put some actual supplies on naval ships that went to Palestine and were able to pass the British blockade. So there was an immense benefit to working with other American humanitarian associations, and especially those which were closest to the state and could be part of the kind of neutral American war effort.
So I think that you highlighted in your last answer the, I think, largest organization that you address in your text. And that's the Joint Distribution Committee, or the JDC. And it really, I think, dominates your story. In addition to facilitating these transfers for individuals, what other roles did the JDC play in this emerging Jewish humanitarian landscape?
So one of the things that led me to this project was that when I was looking at this American humanitarian effort overall, I would see these kinds of lists of organizations and how much money they were giving and where they were going. And the Joint Distribution Committee was always on that list. But one of my first suspicions when I decided to work on Jewish humanitarianism was that I had this hunch that the JDC, I mean, it was just one organization, and typically Jewish organizations do not do a good job of working together. And so I really wanted to investigate a wider field of Jewish humanitarian organizations. But I was surprised to discover that really, in some sense, previous historiography or even like brief archival information seemed to be correct. The truth is that the Joint Distribution Committee really dominated the Jewish humanitarian landscape. Again, because of the relationship it was able to establish with the American state, due to the importance of America and its neutral status in the First World War, and due to a very unusual moment in American Jewish history where, because American Jews were so concerned about the crisis happening in the Jewish homeland and heartland of Eastern Europe, they were able to set aside their differences and come together as a community probably you could say for the first time, and create this one organization. And the reason the word joint is in the title of the organization is because originally it really was a joint organization. It was meant to kind of be an umbrella of other Jewish organizations. And for a long time, it really, in many ways, functioned as an umbrella, with different constituencies having careful representation on its committees. And it really, really worked hard as an organization to maintain itself as the Jewish humanitarian organization, especially when it came to America, and to not let other Jewish projects derail it or challenge it. Usually when other projects arose, the JDC would find a way to absorb those projects into their joint committee. It, however, did not see that it should be the only organization or a longstanding organization in the regions in which it was working in Europe. So what it tried to do was restore pre-existing Jewish organizations, or to create new ones if previous ones didn't exist, or to bring several organizations that were previously in conflict with one another into a working relationship with one another. So the JDC had this idea that Jews should work jointly together to solve this crisis. And they used every means of incentive they could to get their recipients to be self-sufficient, to take charge of the humanitarian aid, but also to do it in a way in which it forced them to work cooperatively with each other.
So as a result of World War I, the globe faced one of the largest refugee crises to date. How did Jews and humanitarian organizations adapt to and respond to this refugee crisis?
Yes. Peter Gatrell's work on World War I and refugees as a kind of especially focused on Russia, but more recently thinking about World War I as an instigator of a global refugee crisis, has been really important in kind of setting out those global stakes. What one chapter of my book does is focus on this refugee crisis in its Jewish dimensions. And one of the things I talk about is how in this era, a mass refugee crisis was sort of created for the first time, with some kind of hope that these refugees might somehow be saved or helped in some way and kept alive. It's difficult to even be able to count how many refugees there were, because it depends on how you would count and how you would define a refugee. Like, are internally displaced people refugees or not? And what if the borders changed rather than the person changing place? There's all these kind of knotty problems that come up, but the Joint Distribution Committee at the time, in 1918, so this wasn't even the end of the refugee crisis, but counted over a million Jewish refugees that were created as a result of the war. Although when most people think of Jewish refugees, they tend to think in the modern period of that mainly being something that happened in Central Europe starting in the 30s, with the rise of the Nazi Party and its anti-Semitic decrees. But in fact, the Jewish refugee crisis started in World War I and it had never been solved. And some say that the mere presence of Jewish refugees in important metropoles in Central Europe might have contributed to the anti-Semitism there, because they were at the margins of society, barely hanging on. And there were just so many Jews in this position throughout the interwar period. The JDC didn't really know exactly how to respond to this and tried to respond basically by minimizing the scope of the problem. It was so overwhelming and was so difficult to do without state power. I mean, the JDC couldn't open borders, that all the JDC could really do was try to provide basic humanitarian relief to during serious crises, and then try to help Jewish refugees kind of settle into the places where they ended up. And what the JDC was basically hoping was that if kind of illegally settled refugees could manage long enough wherever they were, eventually they'd sort of just be integrated into wherever they were in a real way. And so the JDC didn't want to draw attention to them by creating a kind of category of forever refugees. So they would shift refugees from their refugee assistance into just kind of the regular assistance programs pretty quickly. But other Jewish organizations really felt that this was an inappropriate response that was too apologetic. And Hayes, for example, was more intent on working to open borders or to help Jews complete immigration paperwork, to advocate at the highest levels of government where they could, to increase the quotas or at least fill the quotas to their capacity, and to find possible new areas of settlement for Jews in other places of the world, so that Jews could leave. And they courted serious political controversy in so doing, which is mainly why the JDC avoided that approach. But the JDC appreciated the work that Hayes was doing, and supported it as well. So the refugee crisis was a very difficult and knotty problem that essentially they failed in responding to. But it was also a task much bigger than really any non-state organization might be expected to carry out effectively. It required a political solution.
So I'm combining a couple chapters here, but I read them collectively, and I think they really stood out as my favorites. You examine the relationships between social medicine, humanitarianism, resistance, and social welfare. How do these things really come together and intersect in the aftermath of World War I?
As my book starts to move away from the years most typically associated with the First World War, even past 1921, I start to really get into exactly the issues that you bring up here. It's really interesting to me that even well into the 20s, these Jewish organizations thought of themselves as war response organizations and humanitarian organizations, but they were slowly transforming themselves into something that we today might call international development organizations, or at the time was probably more inspired by the idea of a social welfare state, which was something that was happening as states became social welfare states in the West. But in the Jewish case, this was sort of a social welfare state in diaspora. And So rather than kind of reacting to a refugee crisis or food shortages and just kind of throwing whatever materials they could and cash at these problems and having it be very kind of chaotic and no, and, you know, wartime kind of disarray of information and people and logistics. The JDC sort of switched to a longer term planning where they sought to rehabilitate Europe's and the Middle East's Jews and had these kind of much more planned projects, which were thought through and were often done in a kind of small way and then tried to scale them up. And they did these projects, one on health, public health, you could say, or social medicine. There was another project or like theme around children. And then there was another around impoverishment and labor and work conditions. They still thought of themselves as humanitarian and war organization. So, for example, in the public health project, it started out as a response to an epidemic of typhus, which was raging along the Eastern Front. And despite the fact that there is a lot more historical attention to the flu in 1918 along the Eastern Front, typhus was clearly even more of a concern because that's what dominates all of the discussions about health at that moment and dominated efforts made by the new League of Nations in the public health arena. And so the JDC was trying to kind of help and work with the League of Nations and with the US military and local authorities in Poland and in Ukraine when they could to try to stop the spread of typhus, treat Jews who were sick, provide sanitary materials like soap and washing machines so that people could keep themselves clean and prevent the spread of lice, which is what spread typhus itself. It was not especially effective because it was really difficult to coordinate all of those things in the immediate and waning years of a war. But what it did do was kind of create this idea that there were a lot of Jewish health professionals, nurses and doctors, and Jews could undertake public health initiatives amongst themselves and train themselves and improve their living spaces and their sanitary measures. And none of this would be particularly politically controversial. So they could kind of build Jewish society through social medicine and organize through that. And although by the mid-20s, local Jewish organizations were running most of these programs, the TOES and the OZE are maybe acronyms some of the listeners might be familiar with. The joint is kind of what provided the JDC, also known as the joint. The joint is what provided that kind of crucial bridge to kind of get Jewish organizations through the war, through the typhus pandemic, and then organizing anew these Jewish social medicine organizations to to survive in the interwar period.
I think one of the threads that you kind of pull through large swaths of the book is the role of anti-Semitism in shaping Jewish humanitarianism. So can you tell listeners a little bit today about how anti-Semitism in various contexts affected Jewish humanitarianism throughout this period?
One of the things I do constantly throughout the book is think through Jewish humanitarianism in comparison with mainstream or other forms of humanitarianism. And although anti-Semitism appears in various guises throughout the book, one of the things that the thing that I would conclude overall about anti-Semitism and Jewish humanitarianism is that we as Jewish studies scholars often forget, because we are always dealing with anti-Semitism in the background, is that other humanitarian organizations did not have to deal with the baggage of anti-Semitism. Jewish humanitarianism was addressing a war that everyone else was addressing, plus anti-Jewish violence. It was also having to look over its shoulder all the time and worry that the humanitarian work was not just kind of helping people stay alive, which was the goal, but somehow inflaming anti-Semitism in the regions where it was functioning. It meant that it forced Jewish organizations to have to make choices about what they were willing to say and how they were going to say it to the U.S. government for fear of anti-Semitism within the U.S. government, or creating anti-Semitism where it didn't exist, or creating anti-Semitism amongst the American populace if they tried to advocate for more open borders. And, you know, I found in the State Department's archives that, you know, the State Department was incredibly anti-Semitic in this moment. Not just Congress that passed quota laws, but, you know, also the State Department itself. And speaking of those quota laws, I mean, there was legislation that was effectively anti-Semitic trying to keep the Jews that it might be helping out and creating new kinds of problems, because a refugee crisis couldn't be solved if Jews couldn't get into any of the countries that they would like to go to. So, you know, there was just a huge way in which anti-Semitism affected Jewish humanitarianism and shaped it. And, you know, every single conversation in any bit of the JDC, even when it's not stated explicitly, clearly has worries about anti-Semitism in the background. Just every choice that they made, everything that they did was always kind of a calculus of like, which thing that we do will cause the least amount of anti-Semitism, or how do we reduce anti-Semitism with humanitarianism? How do we accomplish our work when our partner organizations are potentially or certainly anti-Semitic? And they just had to always think about it. And it was, the answers were never clear. So, I mean, without looking at the archives, you might not realize how much actual real anti-Semitism did affect it. But you can see, you know, in the State Department, in the papers of the Red Cross, that there really was a lot of difficulties that Jewish humanitarianism faced that any of its peer organizations simply did not have to deal with. It's remarkable how much the Joint and other Jewish humanitarian organizations were able to do given these barriers, really. And also remarkable how under the radar, in some sense, it all was. But that was a choice. It was intentionally under the radar because there were worries that if Jews proclaimed success more loudly, or not even success, but just work, that work would be compromised.
It's a little bit outside of, I think, the purview of your text itself. But one of the primary geographic regions that you are looking at is, of course, Ukraine, and you are dealing with topics of humanitarianism. So I'm wondering if you might share with listeners today maybe some lessons you think that folks can learn from Jewish humanitarianism in the age of the Great War, that they might be able to apply or think about within the context of contemporary humanitarian crises in Ukraine.
As I said briefly earlier in the interview, in the Great War moment, as today, regular people in democratic countries, especially countries not directly involved in the fighting, wanted to do something, and they felt that they should do something. And they felt that their leaders should do something. And the thing that everyone always arrives at, the regular civilian, the regular person arrives at, is humanitarianism. It's, I would argue that humanitarianism has really become a main pillar of modern warfare, starting in the First World War. But we still don't really think about it analytically in that way. And if the media is all about, mainstream media is all about reporting on the ground, and then the Western response being reported is all about the military response and nuclear deterrence, coverage is really lacking in terms of thinking about what the regular person all across the West is doing and what it means, what humanitarianism means, what it can accomplish, what its limits are, who might be the most effective humanitarian actors to donate to or support. So I think that, I mean, there's many different things that my book shows that humanitarianism can be or do, but part of what is missing right now is a kind of understanding that violence in this region and humanitarianism co-evolved. So humanitarianism is very bound to violence in Ukraine. And that diaspora organizations, in the case of my book, Jews, but in the case of now, it could be Jews and Ukrainian diaspora organizations and other diasporas connected to the state of Ukraine. Diaspora organizations are an incredible humanitarian resource and actor because they have the direct knowledge, the connections, basically everything that one needs to conduct successful humanitarian organizations to conduct a successful humanitarian operation, which always combines a kind of need for grassroots and state level and international authority and ability to navigate. And so I think we should be doing a lot more to kind of seek out those diaspora organizations and encourage our states and other citizens to support them And then also advocate for more state-backed humanitarian support along many ways, because we have the technology these days to keep people alive and to solve a lot of problems rather than create more war through more violence.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's something that all of us should be thinking about pretty systematically, ways that we can participate in humanitarian efforts in response to what's going on in Ukraine. Jacqueline, we have taken up quite a bit of your time today. I want to wrap up our interview with my traditional closing question on New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm helping to lead a project funded by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council on Jewish country houses, which we are basically thinking about as a project, which I'm doing with multiple other academics and heritage professionals, and country house museums, Jewish museums. We're thinking about the ways in which essentially rural Jewish owned palaces in the 19th and early 20th centuries fit into the urban and rural divide and class and cultural philanthropy and art in Europe. And I'm particularly working on ideas having to do with politics and liberalism and philanthropy, and also on gender. And I'm planning to write my second book in the context of this project, and in with specific focus on gender. So my second book is provisionally titled Human Rights, Jewish Women, Internationalism from the Salon to the NGO. So I'm looking forward to working more on that now, although I've just gotten published in the last few days a special issue I edited of the Journal of Modern Jewish Studies on gender and Jewish internationalism. So I hope some of the listeners here might also want to check out the articles in that special issue.
I know that that's probably what I'm getting ready to do right now then. Look for that special issue. Thank you for joining us on New Books in Jewish Studies today, Jacqueline.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And for the listeners out there, if today's discussion piqued your interest, which I hope it did, you can pick up a copy of Jacqueline Granick's International Jewish Humanitarianism in the Age of the Great War directly from Cambridge University Press, or you can always order it from your local bookstore.